I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Thank you so much for turning out. I want to pay my respects to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and all the peoples of the Eora Nation on whose land we're meeting today. And from my people, Wiradjuri, Gamilaroi and Dharawal as well, I want to pay respects and bring greetings from my people. And to welcome you all here today as well for this this great opportunity for me to have a conversation with our the inestimable national treasure, Tom Keneally, about my book, forthcoming, about Tom. When I was asked to do this, I was in the midst of writing another book, which is out at the moment as well, with The Falling of the Dusk, and I could not resist the opportunity, even though it sort of made me take a detour. I couldn't resist the opportunity to not engage with this Writers on Writers series, and the first person I thought of was Tom. And the only book I really wanted to write about as a gateway to writing about literature in Australia, about black and white in Australia, about who owns the story in Australia, the book that has been with me for at least 40 years of my life or more, a book that was so influential on how I saw the world as I entered into the world as a young adult, and the book that I've now passed on to my youngest son as he enters the world as a young adult, and that is The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. So it's a real pleasure to be here and have this conversation with Tom today. Just be a very freewheeling conversation amongst two people who've known each other for a very long time, and certainly in my case, respect Tom, yeah, and love Tom enormously. But I wanted to start by just reading the opening of The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, because it's a jumping off point, I think, for what I write about in this book, and for a broader discussion about Australia and writing about Aboriginal people and how Aboriginal people are seen. And it is also, I think, perhaps the most complete opening sentence I've read of any novel ever. In June of 1900, Jimmy Blacksmith's maternal uncle, Tabidji, Jackie Smolders to the white world, was disturbed to get news that Jimmy had married a white girl in the Methodist church at Wallah. Therefore, he set out with Jimmy's initiation tooth to walk 100 miles to Wallah. The tooth would be a remonstration and lay a tribal claim on Jimmy. Tom, there is so much happening in that sentence. Of course, we have the date. It's 1900. What's happening in Australia? Australia is emerging into what will become federation. So we're having the debates about what this Australian nation will be. Jimmy Blacksmith's maternal uncle, Tabidji, that you make a point of saying, Jackie Smolders to the white world, that there is a man who is inhabiting a space in between, having to make himself visible and known to a white world who cannot see Tabidji, but can recognise Jackie Smolders. He's disturbed to get the news that Jimmy had married a white girl, but even more than that, in the Methodist church. There is race and there is religion and there is love and forbidden love. Therefore, he sets out with Jimmy's initiation tooth, a clash of faith, one faith laying a claim against another faith, as a remonstration to lay a tribal claim on Jimmy, that you are putting a claim on someone, that you are saying you belong here and you don't belong there, and that Tabidji Jackie Smolders sees bad times ahead. There is so much happening there philosophically, so much happening there in terms of the narrative. And the language as well, Tom, it's completely unadorned. There's no fancy language. There's no purple prose. In fact, you break laws. In the Methodist church at Wallah, therefore he set out with Jimmy's initiation tooth to walk 100 miles to Wallah. You've repeated it twice in the same, you know, one sentence after another. What, when you construct something like that, to capture all of those ideas, to set up every single thing that is going to play out in that novel, how do you even begin to do that?
Well, I think that sentences like that come from a deep intensity in oneself, a deep pressure. in oneself. And as you know, I spent my early childhood in a town that had an Aboriginal settlement on the Armidale side of town and on the downriver town, Burnt Bridge and Green Hill, they were called. And I'd been carrying my impressions of the Kempsey Aboriginals, Thungudi people, for a long time in my head, and it exerted their pressure on me. Thank God there was a bit of... Persecution is very good for priests and for writers. though the priest
says someone who's almost been one and is certainly another.
And the fact that I came from a Catholic family and a Gaelic name like Kinnear, Murphy is another one, Doyle, you know, there are so many of them. So I was on the cusp of society, but I wasn't as much on the cusp as the kids who passed our fence every Friday afternoon on their way to town in Kempsey. And that's what fascinated me. The old rhyme, my mother said, I never should mix with the gypsies in the wood. It wasn't that my mother said, don't mix with those kids, but that there were other and that they couldn't sit in the same part of the cinema as mine, as me, and other mysteries about them, including their state of health, that never left me and emerges in a sentence like that with the incantatory repetition of one.
Exactly. And Tom, why Jimmy Blacksmith? Now, of course, Jimmy Blacksmith is based on a real character, Jimmy Governor. And if you buy the book and read the book, you will see that my family has a deep connection with the real Jimmy Governor.
Yes, you are related to Jimmy's white wife.
Well, yes. What happened was...
So I nicked his book.
Exactly. This is the nature of sort of Aboriginal families too, of course, is that we... are descended from white and black. We become something different, something new. Jimmy Governor and his family grew up on the same missions as my dad's father and his mother and his grandparents. I've got photographs of Jimmy's younger brother standing next to my great aunt. Jimmy's white wife, Ethel, after Jimmy was executed at Darlinghurst Jail, she moved to the south coast of New South Wales and she married another Aboriginal man. She already had a son to Jimmy and she married another Aboriginal man and she had children. And her grandson married my father's sister. So in the nature of Aboriginal families, there's not many of us. And we marry white people and then we marry each other and we draw these connections. So I'd grown up with the Jimmy Governor story. He was a part of my story's family and I had blood cousins who had a direct relationship to Jimmy and his wife, direct relationship. So when you read the story of Jimmy Governor, how did that speak to what Jimmy Blacksmith would become?
I think I'd gone back to Kempsey and done some pieces for the National Times, the old National Times that used to be edited by Max Such. And I believe that, I know that I spoke to a number of health professionals about Aboriginal health, because that was one of the things that was used both as a means of, semi-conscious means of killing Aboriginals, but also of dividing them from the rest of the town. And I heard some fascinating stuff, but often from practitioners who were in a sort of despair. And you are very critical of the book, probably justly so, in the ground. Well, you've lived this life. You know better than me. On the grounds that there isn't quite as much despair as there would look to be. In fact, there isn't despair.
It was really interesting because this book has, as I said, it's been with me forever. And I've had, you know, like any great piece of art, great piece of literature, it's the questions it demands of you rather than the answers it provides that keeps bringing us back to it. If a piece of literature answers all the questions, we don't need to read it again. But in The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, it kept asking me things. It kept revealing different things to me. And my relationship with it has changed so much over the years. I first came to the book, of course, via the film, as so many other people would have. That extraordinary film of Fred Skepsis that was, even by today's standards, an explosively violent film.
Mm.
And I saw the film, and when I saw the film as a young Aboriginal boy emerging into a world of whiteness, coming out of the history that I had, a history of violence, and with that sense of resentment at our history, having grown up with those stories, when Jimmy struck that blow, he struck it for us. Something rose in me. It was an exhilarating thing, and it's a disturbing thing to think that someone raining violence down on women and children can speak to something in you. And yet, of course, we know that's what the history of the world tells us, that we emerge out of that grievance and violence. And of course, as I read your book, it fortified me against that world. It gave me something. But as I've grown and I've read the book over and over and I've challenged myself, I also see, just as that first sentence described, that you saw us as doomed. Tabidji is doomed. He can only be Jackie Smulders to the white world. Jimmy is doomed. His love is doomed. He's doomed by his faith. He's doomed by his culture. And he's doomed by a white world. And I can't accept that we are doomed, because I know I wouldn't be here if
yes.
that was the case.
And of course it was easier for... Well, what I did, I mean, the founding... The original sin, which is the basis of our talk today, was that I adopted in the novel a black consciousness. About 20 years ago, I believe, I said, and it was, the fact was publicized, that I would not write the novel that way now.
Mm. Not that you would not write the novel, but you would not write the novel that way,
yes,
in an Aboriginal voice.
And assume an Aboriginal voice. And I feel I did the wrong thing in my dumb post-colonial way, because for a number, if it were a choice between being hanged as Jimmy was and having the judge take things into consideration, I would say take in consideration the fact that there seemed to have been little that had changed since the referendum.
Mm, in 67,
and the health
yeah.
of Burnt Bridge people, particularly of Greenhill people, those two camps were ultimately brought into one. The health of the Aboriginal people in Greenhill on the Armidale Road and further up the Maclay Valley was just as catastrophic, mm. it seemed, as it was in descriptions from the early 20th century. And so I planted my white view on all this. In other ways, people of the Maclay Valley took a false reassurance from some Aboriginals when on the way down to Southwest Rocks we would cross Kinchula Boys Home. We would pass Kinchula.
Where young boys in the stolen generations were sent.
Stolen generation, abuse, everything that is heartbreaking. And these kids would run down to the road and whites would all say, "They're such happy kids in there." And this is the sort of misunderstanding that I was bringing.
But it's really interesting though, Tom, because of course you write the book in 1972. You mentioned the 67 referendum. 1972, we'd seen the Aboriginal Tent Embassy established. There was the burgeoning Aboriginal political movement, mm-hmm. a much more strident, some would say an even militant movement, but certainly much more urgent and in your face. Australia was emerging out of the conservative years and into the Whitlam years. There was the Vietnam War, of course, and you're writing against that period. The Boer War, in many respects, set during the chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, stands in for the Vietnam War. And I always felt as though, I mean, you and I share so much, a shared Irish heritage. We're outsiders, both by our birth and our choice. We probably love words more than we love people, and that's disturbing to reveal, but it's probably true. We trust words more than we trust people. And there was a lot of your, if you swap the Aboriginal faith for Catholicism, if you swap Aboriginal resentment and grievance for Fenian grievance, there was a lot in Jimmy Blacksmith that was Tom Keneally.
Sure. I think in the background of the Irish, we don't understand how disenfranchised people were in the old world and how fragile was their life. There were Irish who said when Frederick Douglass was campaigning against
the great African-American
in
orator
Dublin,
and scholar.
Yeah, and in Cork and all the major cities, they said, give us 2 meals a day and we'll volunteer to be slaves. The starving said they didn't get their 2 meals a day and they did die. So the fact that there was such a disenfranchisement in Ireland that included neglect of education, included a structural land injustice, inequity.
So that informed the book.
And I think that's why we're such pisspots, because, the Irish, because our men were defeated again and again. The penal colonies were full of men, including an uncle
of mine. And this is really interesting, Tom. And this is, I think, where, as I've grown and as I've looked at the book, there are two things that I've grappled with. One is, and this is a reflection on myself, why did I feel the need to identify myself through a history of grievance and resentment and violence?
Mm-hmm.
Why did that speak to me so powerfully? And is there something fundamentally wrong with me if that is the case? And in all the reporting I've done around the world, the conflicts of our age are rooted in an unending sense of historical grievances. The philosopher Nietzsche would have said, in all historical fever, the man of resentment. Xi Jinping talks about the 100 years of humiliation. Vladimir Putin talks about the collapse of the Soviet Empire as the great catastrophe of the 20th century. We know that Hitler played on ideas of German resentment and the mistreatment of Germany after the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, Osama bin Laden talked about the end of the Ottoman Empire and the resentment of the West. There is something in our history that speaks powerfully to us, and I had to challenge that in myself. The other thing I had to confront was why we as a people are not seen with the same capacity for progress and growth that others. And it's interesting you mentioned the Irish, because there is an Irish character in the book, Tobin, who is part of the posse searching for Jimmy Blacksmith after he's committed the murders. And Tobin at one point says, you know, about Australia, this is a place where a man can really make something of himself. Back home, we had nothing. Here, we can be kings. Even someone who emerges out of that horrible oppression of the Irish comes to Australia and sees a future. But you don't see a future for Jimmy or Tobidji.
No.
Why? Why don't we have a future?
I'm afraid, except for the Irish that intermarried, I suppose, there's a tendency to thank God that there was someone we were superior to. And you tramp on the knuckles of the man on the ladder underneath you when you're climbing a ladder out of a stormy sea onto the security of a deck. And I'm afraid that's what happened here. As well as that, the dreaming of Europe, and may I say, this obsession with the European dreaming, if you don't mind me snatching that.
Because there is an Irish purely, dreaming too, in a sense.
And it's very much of livestock. Ned Kelly's father is sent to Australia for stealing a pig. Livestock were sacred. The border people who settled the West from England and Scotland would hang men for stealing cattle. Mm. Livestock was more significant.
I think also livestock and land, and you make a point that Jimmy Blacksmith makes after he marries and he's looking for a home, he's looking to have land, he sees that that's what white people have, and he says, home and hearth. With that, a man is beatified. That completes you as a person in Australia, home and hearth. But it's really interesting, Tom. Again, this is where, when as I've sort of tried to take the scales from my own eyes and examine myself and then wrestle with this brilliant book that has disturbed me, challenged me, I've loved it, I've hated it, I've wrestled with it. If I look at the real Jimmy Governor, he is a man who, yes, he wants in. He wants into the wider world. He demands the right to love whomever he wants to love, to marry a white woman. He says, I am as good as any white man. He also says, I am not like those other blacks, not because he despises other black people, but because he will not allow white people to define him in that way. And when I grew up with people like this, my grandfather, my father, proud Aboriginal men. My grandfather went and served in the war. My grandmother said to him after he enlisted, why have you done this? What has this country ever done for us? And he said, because it is my country. And my father, who has held on to our language, written the first Wiradjuri dictionary, who's been beaten down literally by this country over the years, and says, I give back to this country because it is my country. They were never doomed figures. And I wrote this in the book, and I just want to read this to lead up to the next bit of our conversation. Tom Keneally could not possibly understand Jimmy Governor, as he could not possibly comprehend my father, as he invented his own Aborigine, Jimmy Blacksmith. Tom is an outsider. He has said that is the reason he writes. And in Jimmy, he creates the archetypal outsider. I don't think I'm wrong in seeing Black Jimmy as Irish Tom's mirror image. Swap Fenny and grievance for Aboriginal resentment, the dreaming for Catholic ritual, and Indigenous sovereignty for Irish republicanism. Jimmy Blacksmith is a memory without memory, a faint trace of the real Jimmy Governor, now existing in the inner eye of the white author, who can't see him as anything more than a man trapped between worlds. Keneally's Jimmy Blacksmith is stripped of modernity's great promise, progress. All the white people in the book all have progress. The Irishman Tobin has progress. Even the family of the victims, they have a future. They are in this land.
Australia has a future.
Australia has a future. And this was the issue I kept coming back and back and back to. And I struggle with it all the time. Why do we not have that future? Why does, when Manning Clark writes the history of Australia, the first line is that civilization arrived in Australia with the coming of the British? Why does William Stanner, that wonderful anthropologist who wrote about Aboriginal people, and he said that basically he looked at Aboriginal society coming into contact with white society, and he saw something in decline, something that shattered at the touch of modernity. And yet, in the middle of all of this, we're embracing Christianity. We're working on the roads. We're droving the cattle and the sheep. We're building the fences. We're picking the fruit. We're telling new stories. We're marrying other people. We're raising our families. We knew we had progress. And if there is a sin in the book for me, Tom, it is that you cannot see us as people imbued with the same humanity as white people who, in spite of all their sins and all their crimes and all the brutality, would have a future and we wouldn't.
Yeah. By the way, the reason I remember at the time being very anxious about explaining Jimmy's rugged brutality in terms of his being at war, which was an idea he'd got through the Boer War. And ironically, the real Jimmy Governor and Jimmy Blacksmith in the novel, they keep troops back to hunt him. Now, that is very significant. They'd love the Australian passion for participating in foreign wars, the idea that was around when I was a kid that the best chance of a trip is to fight in foreign wars. And thus, my father enlists for a job and a trip. And you see the pyramids in his case, but you probably die for the privilege. Basically, you're pointing out the reasons why it is a form of theft, which some people would say minor and others consider major, to steal the identity of another extraordinarily complex culture and to speak from within it, from within the gut, from within the flesh, to incarnate your voice in an Aboriginal. Now, I'm not fussy about these things. I'll normally incarnate my voice anywhere. In this case, when all else, including the continent, has been stolen, it seems to be an added step to take an Aboriginal voice and to make your fiction in it. And that was the basis of my admitting that there'd been a kind of cultural acquisition problem at the time, innocently incurred by myself, but with the right
sort of motive. See, you're writing Jimmy Blacksmith as a mirror to Australia. You're saying, look what you have done. This is what you have done. This is what led to this crime. This is why Jimmy hit out. This is why we look around Australia and we see this ongoing suffering. And every bit of that is true. And yet, in the act of that, we lose something as Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
It's really, I made a reference in the book to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, you know, the wonderful book that the African-American writer and novelist had written. And he says, I entered the world of white Australia as an invisible man. In the words of Ralph Ellison, people refuse to see me. People like me wonder if we are not phantoms ourselves, ghosts. Ellison said, we want to be real, that we ache with the need to convince ourselves that we exist, but we are just figments of the imagination. In Ellison's case, of the white imagination. We appear only in the inner eyes of those who look upon us. They can't see us as we truly are, so they invent us. Not fully human, but something that resembles human. Aboriginal people only come into view when they become something white people recognise. And I'm wondering, Tom, when you wrote the book, was this the only Aboriginal person you could recognise? The man caught between, the man who is doomed, the man who lashes out, the man put upon, the humiliated man, but the man for whom there is no future, whether it's Tabidji, whether it's Jimmy's brother Mort, whether it is Jimmy himself. Is that the only way you could see us?
I'd have to say at that time, touché. You know, it didn't seem that we had advanced greatly past the thing. I mean, the Australia that formed me was an Australia in which you all had to be back at Burnt Bridge or Greenhill by 6 o'clock, or the cops would be on the road preying on you. Those who had the mind to pray could have. It was a blacks camp where a white man could go and sell a mixture of methylated spirits and rosehip syrup. Because
so you were looking around, so and you were seeing a doomed people, and you were reflecting that. What you weren't seeing was what was happening inside those camps.
That's
people
exactly
who
right.
loved, people who played cricket,
and the women.
People who played, and the women. I want to come to the women. This is the hardest part of the conversation, and this was the hardest part of the book for me, because the women had no redeeming feature at all. Many of the white women didn't either, but the black women had no redeeming features. And I knew these women because this was my grandmother and my great-grandmother. These are the women who had raised me. And I just want to read this bit and come to this conversation because it is the hardest one. It is the hardest part. There is no love in Keneally's novel. The blacks are deformed by the lack of love. The women especially are loathsome. Degraded creatures, TB riddled, coughing, heaving, vomiting, wenches, gins and lubras, who Jimmy takes refuge in and then despises for having done so. Jimmy himself was conceived out of lust and violence, the product of a visit some white man made to Brentwood Black's camp, and the weak, vile black men in Tom's novel sell their women for the price of rum. I have to say, the way Keneally writes about black women disturbs me. He seems to reserve a special venom for them. They are contemptible creatures. I know he is reflecting the times in which the book is set, when white men preyed on black women, but I can't help recoiling from the language. Black women sing shrieking welcomes to the white phallus, powerful demolisher of tribes. Jimmy lies down with a scrawny gin called Florence, who Keneally writes barked and barked and dredged blood from beneath her lips. Compare that to how Keneally describes a white woman whom Jimmy sees passing by, who had an aura of being delicate, with fat acquiescent lips, distant eyes, full and ripe. She is Jimmy's fantasy, a symbol, a state of blessedness. By contrast, the black women are the work of the devil, immoral vessels devoid of any virtue and dwelling in the worst rooms of hell. It was hard...
If I was saying again, pleading extenuation, I would say that is, if I might tell a parallel story that might resonate with you, some years ago, Judy and I were in the Ute reservation in Colorado, and we're going into town, and we picked up three Native Americans who were going into town, and two of them were women, and they were gone. They were not even there to tell you the truth, because they had drunk ruinous liquors that had kind of dislodged their brains. And they're the people, that's why I think it is not an insignificant thing to steal someone's point of view, because you don't have the inner knowledge.
You can't see what that woman is feeling.
Your knowledge of the natives is based on things you see as a child in potentially squalid. You know something squalid's going on. You don't know what it is.
And of course,
that was certainly the case at that period of history. It was an outrage that the Aboriginal women were as they were. It's not naturally. I know you accede to the proposition that I'm not saying black women.
No.
But it is in part something from scenes that one saw in.
And again, what you're seeing is not what we're living.
Yes, that's right.
Because of course these women, who are my grandmother and my great-grandmother, are women with abundant love. They had extraordinary love and endless love. And yes, some of the horrible things that were done to them never extinguished that inexhaustible love. And I couldn't see that in the book. One of the things I was really mindful of when I came to write this, and Tom and I were having this chat just before we came up here, is there's this big question: who gets to write a book? And I don't like putting literature on trial. I don't think you can hold art up to judgment. It is what it is. I'm glad Tom wrote the book. I'm glad the book was written when it was written, because it has given me something to wrestle with. It's given me something to bite down on. It's revealed things to me. In where you have failed, it's revealed things to me, and it's revealed things about Australia, and it's revealed things about how white people see us. It gives me something to write back to. And within the book, it is an extraordinary piece of literature on top of all of that. It is a book, if I was giving any Australian book to anyone overseas, it would be this, to say, read this for all it says and all it doesn't say, and then explore this country from that point. I don't like putting art or literature on trial, but I do like the idea that we can ask ourselves harder questions. What's the question, when you're asked that question today, Tom, about who has the right to write a book? You have still written Aboriginal characters. You wrote about two old men dying, and one of them was the Mungo Man.
Yes.
You've written an Aboriginal character.
I claim
in the
that
Boy.
Because our crowd, at the time Mungo Man lived in Lake Mungo, we were nomads too, and we were living a much more miserable life than you, because we didn't have all this protein on the hoof that was going down to water itself. We didn't have the Prodotaur. We had the saber-toothed tiger. Thank you a lot. And I feel that nomadic life, that life in which everyone is a priest, everyone is a dancer, everyone is an artist, everyone is a storyteller, that world is closer to us than we think.
And it was really interesting, I think, when I read that book, I see that, of course, Mungo Man has an inner life much greater than Jimmy does in some respects.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that really struck me in reading this is, and it's true in general, that we are invented by white people. There are no Aborigines here before white people came. There were Gamilaroi and Wiradjuri and Aranda and Galgadoon and Eora. There were so many other people. We were not Aboriginal people. There was a whole lot of different peoples. And we become Aboriginal. We become something where we're fixed in that eye. We're invented. You felt the need to invent Jimmy Blacksmith because Jimmy Governor wasn't... You weren't able to capture all those questions just in the life of Jimmy Governor, so you create Jimmy Blacksmith. And yet Oscar Schindler, a man with all of his contradictions, a man part of that horrendous Nazi regime, can live on the page with his own name. Why that? Why that? Why are we invented to tell a story, and yet even a Nazi can live on the page with their own name?
Well, I think it's because shamefully... European culture has had, from the time of the Roman Empire onwards, an anti-Semitism. So we, reading about the Holocaust, I don't know if this is probably your experience or you might be much nobler people, but I asked myself what I would have done in that situation. With a bit more cranking up of the anti-Semitism, which is there in, sadly, in Christianity too. It's part of our inheritance.
But Oscar was someone you could see fully.
Yes.
Whereas Jimmy was someone you had to invent.
And that's why I should have told the story, if I were doing it again, from the point of view of MacReady,
yes,
the school teacher.
Yes.
But,
That's another novel. That's another novel.
May I say, William Styron, who wrote the Something of Mac Nat Turner, The Fortunes of Nat Turner.
Right.
It's a famous book about the Confessions of Nat Turner. It's about a slave rebellion in 1831, which really was nearly the death knell, was the death knell of slavery, though it took another 30 years to die. And William Styron was a white writer from the South, and a lot of African Americans never forgave him for writing that book. And I always thought, gee, all these Aboriginal aunties who I ask pardon of say, that's okay, love, don't do it again. And I thought, I've got a way with... and I thought, one day I'll have to face up to the crime. And so here I am.
And so we're here today.
Time's up, unfortunately. This is a conversation that could go all day, and hopefully it'll continue amongst you. And
Tom
and I will always have this conversation. Thank you so much.
We could do YouTube.
We could.
We could get to the point where we do have a brawl.
That will never happen. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you to Tom Keneally and everything he has done and everything he's written for our country. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.